I beg pardon, sire. Won't we hit our own troops?
Yes. But we'll hit theirs as well. We have reserves.
The real great adventures of me, Tom Terrific, with Mighty Manfred the Wonder Dog. Greatest hero ever. Terrific is the name for me, 'cause I'm so clever. I can be what I wanna be, and if you'd like to see, follow, come follow me. If you see a plane on high, a diesel train go roaring by, a bumblebee or a tree, it's me! When there is trouble, I'm there on the double, from Atlantic to Pacific. They know I'm terrific.
I'm Mighty Manfred, the Wonder Dog, and Tom's ever faithful companion.
Yeah, that's Terrible Tommy and his Wonder Dog, Natasha. And also Maximilian, the little runt dog. Yeah. Hey, it's June the 28th, 2016. And that means you've only got a couple, 3 days to get this thing done that you've planned so sinister-like for a long time. You've defied the feds and everybody else, and you've been planning and planning and planning. You only got 3 days to pull it off. Otherwise, you got to wait till July. How about that? Well, I guess we finally got the attention of the powers that be in the ruling class, because now that it seems to be threatening their money supply, they're coming unglued all over the place. They see the handwriting on the wall that some of these days that European Union's going to crumble, which is good for us, as a lot of things are going to crumble in this country also. So they're starting to gear up. And if you don't see it in the news, on television, on the internet, you better wake up, because they're getting ready to come after. They're talking about the lone wolves and everybody else. Of course, they just use those names and, white supremacists and neo-Nazis and all that. That's just their fun and game stuff. In the preparatory stages for an all-out war on you and me. But we can say Operation Chaos is in the second stage, and it's going well. And so our side's got some wins too. How about that? I enjoy nothing more than these talking heads sounding like a hen house full of chickens. When you go in to feed them, and if you make the wrong move, they're all in the air at the same time. I remember when I was a kid and I used to feed 1,000 chickens working for a lady near me right now, or just around the corner from where I'm at right now. You go in that hen house with 1,000 chickens, and if you made a quick move, they'd all be in the air screaming at the same time, with dust flying and everything. All these modern leaders and corporate press people remind me of those chickens. Something excites them and they're all in the air at the same time, squawking. They're such worthless sons of bitches. They're all experts. They're all getting a lot of money. They'd all sell out their own mother. They're on television 24 hours a day. What are they going to do? Well, I don't know. What did they do yesterday? Well, they're going to do the same thing tomorrow. Are they going to do that? I don't think so. The only thing you can do is laugh and turn them off, because they don't know shit from shinola. But there is a big frontal attack emerging out of the EU that will probably include people like you and me. I'll introduce you to it in just a minute. But don't forget, we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46580. That's where you send your dues, and they'll soon be due the dues. So listen to this, boys and girls. A new study indicates far-right-wing lone wolves may kill more than lone wolf Islamic terrorists. Yeah. You notice how they never say far-left-wing radicals? It's always far-right-wing radicals, which means about as much as this silly term neo-Nazi or white supremacist. There have been a lot of terrible and electrifying acts of violence throughout the world over the past couple of decades. No, actually forever. Because governments employ more terrorism than anybody else. They don't want you to remember that. Lone wolf terrorism seems to be fermenting in places we can't quite pin down. Not all terrorism or terrorists stem from the same set of circumstances. Some of it is based on religious dogmatism. I guess you'd say that's Islam, or Christianity, or Judaism. Some of it originates with far-right rhetoric. Never far left rhetoric. And other segments, they did add that on. And other segments stem from a far left agenda. The Royal United Service Institute, or RUSI, has been studying the numbers from deadly lone wolf attacks carried out in Europe between 2000 and 2014. Since they only studied lone wolf attacks, the events in Paris and Brussels fell outside their purview. RUSI set up a study that, and of course this is funded by the EU, that seeks to improve understanding of lone wolf terrorists, their behavior and their activities in the period leading up to their intended attack. Well, it's quite simple. It's individual guerrilla warfare. Basically, they want to know why are people carrying out attacks solo, and how do we stop someone who operates outside a known terror network? Well, it's a lot easier to pull off as a lone wolf. That's why. Everybody's learned that organizations are full of informants. There are not a lot of easy answers in the data. RUSI found that right-wing extremists kill and injure more people in lone wolf attacks than Islamic terrorists acting alone. Well, that's an interesting choice of words. I think they're playing games with words when they say that. The numbers between 2000 and 2014 added up to the following. 94 people were killed and 260 were injured in attacks by far-right terrorists. In contrast, religious-inspired lone wolf attacks killed 16 and injured 65. RUSI also found that the mental health is a contributing factor. Well, I would say that's true in a lot of cases. But only around one quarter of the time. 24% of the perpetrators of religious-inspired attacks had a history of mental illness, while 28% of far-right-inspired attackers had a history of mental illness. Interestingly, but maybe not surprisingly, 96% of the perpetrators who carried out lone wolf attacks are men. Color men bad, especially white men. RUSI concludes that more access to mental health care is needed to stem these acts of violence. Well, that's why they close up all the mental hospitals in this country, because they want more violence. Ronald Reagan wanted more violence because he closed up all the mental hospitals in California when he was governor. Obviously, he wanted more violence. With mental health only being a factor in a quarter of the cases, and I don't see how they can be very exact on that, Roussy makes it clear that there are a lot more that needs to be done. Cutting down freedom of speech is one. The study of data showing some harrowing numbers in law enforcement's ability to stop lone wolf attackers before they actually carry out their attacks. When it came to catching a far-right extremist, quote, it was established that 40% of right-wing extremists were uncovered by an element of chance, unquote. Part of that is also because only 18% of the lone wolf far-right extremists talked about their plans. Five words. You get that? Only 18% of the lone wolf far-right extremists talked about their plans. Evidently, they just dreamed it up and did it. So basically, the majority of these attacks were stopped by blind, dumb luck. Conversely, some data also shows that when it comes to religiously inspired terrorism, mostly Muslim, 88% of the interventions were intelligence-led, in other words, spies and informants. Moreover, 45% of religiously inspired lone wolves talked about their plans openly. That's 88% of all the lone wolf terrorist plots that were stopped directly due to intelligence and law enforcement community and informants, snitches, and so forth. That is a lot of plots. Roussy cites that our law enforcement is actually getting better at this, and terror groups are noticing. Yeah, they're getting better at infiltrating and informing on people and planting more and more an army of snitches within all kinds of organizations. No matter how law-abiding they are. I hate those words, law-abiding. Intelligence agencies and law enforcement have become increasingly adept at detecting and disrupting large-scale terrorist plots. Potential attackers have instead turned to smaller-scale, less sophisticated assaults. In part, this trend reflects a decision by wider extremist groups to adopt lone wolf terrorism as a tactic. This seems to be a puzzle that we are only now getting a handle on. The numbers don't lie, but what we do with these numbers matter. At the moment, the study concludes, the media and consequently public attention is largely focused on violent Islamic extremists. While this may reflect the broader threat, it is at odds with that from lone actor terrorism. There you go. Now you can dig up this Roussy outfit at www.rusi.org. Now this is the one that's obviously funded by the EU, and it's a major study into naughty boys and girls. Lone actor terrorism. I'm not going to read you this whole thing because it's a big deal. This project aims to improve understanding of and responses to the phenomenon of lone actors through analysis of comprehensive data on cases from across Europe. There you go. Then they go into the latest reports. They've got literature review, definitional workshop, database workshop, analysis paper, policy paper 1, personal characteristics of lone actor terrorists, policy paper 2, attack methodology and logistics, policy paper 3, motivations, political engagement, and online activity. That might be interesting. Policy 4, leakage and interaction with authorities. Toolkit Paper 1, Practical Guidance for Mental Health Practitioners and Social Workers. Toolkit Paper 2, Practical Guidance for Security Practitioners. Final Report. As intelligence agencies and law enforcement have become increasingly adept at detecting and disrupting large-scale terrorist plots, potential attackers have instead turned to smaller-scale, less sophisticated assaults. In part, this trend reflects a decision by wider extremist groups like the Pentagon and the military-industrial complex to adopt lone actor active terrorism as a tactic, with both Daesh and Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula trying to inspire their supporters to carry out such attacks. In other cases, individuals, dyads, and triads judge that a lone actor will have greater chance of success, or perhaps lack connections to a wider network. Whatever the case, there is a growing trend of individuals and small cells acting in isolation from a wider group of to conduct terrorist activity. Oh, I remember when the right wing said Metzger was nuts. They still say it when I talked about lone wolf activity and staying out of groups and all that. Well, for whatever reason, it works. Whether it's just plain to be keep private and keep government and other people out of your business or whatever, lone wolf works. And it works if people want to be naughty, too. This big study was put together by Chatham House, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, which means Britain, and also the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, and also the University of Leiden in Germany. So they were contracted by EU to figure these things out. Of course, lone wolf can be figured out on maybe a couple of pieces of paper. You don't need a big study. Well, let's check crime in Chi-Town. How about that black KKK? Boy, they're doing a bang-up job, I'll tell you that. 7 killed last weekend in Chicago. At least 51 wounded in the weekend shootings across Chicago. 7 people were killed and at least 51 people were wounded in the weekend shootings across Chicago. So far this year, over 1,880 people have been victims of the black KKK. Oh yes, and at least 317 people have been killed in Chicago this year by shooting, stabbing, or other means. How about that? That's called birth control. Late term. Here's a little tidbit. In Chicago in 1957, there were only 28 murders in August. In 2015, but in August, there were 55 murders. The farther you go back in history, and the whiter Chicago was, the less murders there were. Interesting. Well, for almost 2 years, a protest movement known as Black Lives Matter has convulsed the nation, triggered by the police shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, in August 2014. The Black Lives Matter More movement holds that racist police cops are the greatest threat facing young black men today. This belief has triggered riots and die-ins, the murder and attempted murder of police officers, and a campaign to eliminate traditional grand jury proceedings when police use lethal force. Even though the U.S. Justice Department has resoundingly disproved the lie that a specific Michael Brown was shot in cold blood while trying to surrender, Brown is still venerated as a martyr and a hero. And now police officers are backing off of off of proactive policing in the face of relentless venom directed at them on the street and the media. Violent crime as a result is on the rise. The need is urgent, therefore, to examine Black Lives Matter movement's central thesis that police pose the greatest threat to young black men. I propose two counter-arguments. First, that there is no government agency more dedicated to the idea that black lives matter than the police. Well, I don't know about that. And second, that we have been talking obsessively about alleged police racism over the last 20 years in order to avoid talking about a far larger problem, black on black crime. Every year, approximately 60,000 black people are murdered. This is a number greater than the white and Hispanic homicide victims combined, even though only 13% of the national population is black. Blacks are killed at 6 times the rate of whites and Hispanics combined. Who is killing them? Well, not the police, and not white civilians, but other black people. The astronomical black death of homicide rate is a function of black crime rate. Black males between the ages of 14 and 17 commit homicide at 10 times the rate of white and Hispanic male teens combined. Black people of all ages commit homicide at 8 times the rates of whites and Hispanics combined, and at 11 times the rate of whites alone. The percentage of black people among the civilians killed by police, 26%, is less than what the black crime rate would predict, since police shootings will occur most often in areas where cops are confronting violent, armed criminals and people resisting arrest. 40% of all cop killers have been black males over the last decade. Even though black males are only 6% of the nation's population. Yet standard anti-cop ideology holds that law enforcement actions are racist if they don't mirror the population data. New York City illustrates why that expectation is so misguided. Black people make up 23% of New York City's population, but they commit 75% of all the shootings, 70% of all the robberies, and 66% of all the violent crime, according to victims and witnesses. Add Hispanic shootings and you can account for 98% of all illegal gunfire in the city. Whites are 33% of the city's population, but they commit fewer than 2% of all shootings, 4% of all robberies, 5% of all violent crime. These disparities mean that virtually every time the police in New York are called out on a gun run, meaning that someone has just been shot, they're being summoned to a minority neighborhood looking for minority suspects. Thankfully, such calls are rarer today than in the past, but not that much rarer. In New York City in 1990, for example, there were 2,245 homicides. In 2014, there were 333, a decrease of 85%. Nationwide, crime has fallen at a historic rate as well, by about 40% since the early 1990s. The greatest beneficiaries of these declining rates have to be minorities, non-white people. Over 10,000 minority males alive today in New York would be dead if the city's homicide rate had remained its early 1990s level. What is behind this historic crime drop? A policing revolution that began in New York and spread nationally. A policing revolution that began in New York City and spread nationally. Starting in 1994, the top brass of the New York PD embraced the then radical idea that police can actually prevent crime, not just respond to it. They started gathering and analyzing crime data on a daily and then hourly basis. Equally important, they held commanders accountable for crime in their jurisdictions. Department leaders started meeting weekly with precinct commanders to grill them on crime patterns and on their watch. These weekly accountability sessions came to be known as CompStat. They were ruthless, high-tension affairs. If a commander was not fully informed about every local crime outbreak and ready for a strategy to combat it, his career was in jeopardy. CompStat was widely adopted, keeping police departments intensely focused on where people are most being victimized, and that is in minority communities, non-white communities. In terms of economic stimulus alone, no other government program has come close to the success of data-driven policing, which has opened up previously crime-ridden neighborhoods for new businesses and residents. But the crime victories of the last two decades, and the moral support of which law and order depends, are now in jeopardy thanks to the falsehood of Black Lives Matter. Police operating in the inner city neighborhoods now find themselves routinely surrounded by cursing, jeering crowds of Negroes when they make a pedestrian stop or try to arrest a subject. Now remember the Watts riots in California, and I was there close to it at the time, started because it was on a hot summer day, and a cop stopped a black woman for a failure to yield at a stop sign, and a crowd gathered, and that's when it all started, just from one little traffic infraction. The whole hundreds of millions of dollars in property lost and people killed. That's why you got to keep an eye on these darkies. Sometimes bottles and rocks are thrown. Bystanders stick cell phones in the officers' faces, daring them to proceed with their duties. Officers are worried about becoming the next racist cop of the week and possibly losing their livelihood thanks to an incomplete cell phone video that inevitably fails to show the antecedents to their use of force. That's a pretty damn good article. Very informative. That's something you should share with your friends when they give you all this bullshit about the poor, downtrodden, and beat up and hurt Negroes. Just imagine the United States void of all Negroes. Just think about it. Just sit down for a while and have a drink and think it over. What would this country be like with no Negroes? Oh boy, I think it would be pretty damn nice. Here's what they consider white crime now and white terrorism. Two Missouri men were arrested over the weekend after surveillance video confirmed that they were responsible for throwing eggs at black Americans waiting at bus stops during a hate crime spree that lasted months. That's a hate crime? That's a Halloween prank. According to the St. Louis Police Department, David Rangane and Jesse Reed were seen throwing eggs and shouting racial slurs at a black woman waiting at a bus stop on Friday night. Well, I admit it's a wasteful activity, but to call it a hate crime? A white van accompanied by two white males approached the bus stop yelling offensive, hateful language, in other words, "Hey, nigga." St. Louis Police Chief Sam Dotson explained officers were quickly able to work with the real-time crime center to identify a van, identifying a plate, and finding two occupants. At the same time, across town, five people were butchered by Negro criminals. That's not a hate crime.
St. Louis Police Chief Sam Dotson holds a news conference late this afternoon to provide details of an assault in South St. Louis he says may have been racially motivated.
So Dotson says last night a group of people were driving around South St. Louis throwing eggs at people. Two people are now in custody. 30-year-old Jesse Reed of High Ridge and 30-year-old David Reagan of Fenton. They're both charged with third-degree assault motivated by discrimination. And Dotson says this all happened near a bus stop on South Grand. Dotson says the incident was racially charged because the men who threw the eggs are white. The female victim waiting at the bus stop is black.
A woman, an African-American woman, is waiting at a bus stop, waiting for the bus, as she does quite often, when a white van occupied by two white males approached the bus stop, began yelling offensive, hateful language motivated by race towards her. At the same time, they began to throw eggs at her and other individuals that were standing at the bus stop. She was struck by an egg. The police department was contacted, and officers responded to the area as quickly as we could.
Now, the suspect's cash only bonds are set at $2,000. The chief says the city had just installed new cameras and license plate readers at the location, and that led to the quick arrests of the two suspects.
Run for your lives! Run for your lives! The white heterosexual egg throwers are on the loose. Well, here's a cute little story about Eli Weasel. Remember him? His nose grows longer with each year he lives. 12 years after his liberation from Buchenwald, Eli Weasel found himself in the happiest place on earth. At the time, he was a struggling journalist in New York and working as a foreign correspondent at the United Nations for the Tel Aviv-based newspaper Yediot Aharonot. Yediot. I'm not making that up. To earn some extra money, Weasel wrote Yiddish articles in Der Morgen Journal, submitted a 26-chapter serialized novel of Der Amerikaner, and contributed a regular Yiddish column to the Forberts. But in early 1957, Weasel was slowly recovering from his injuries after being hit by a car in Manhattan's Times Square, driven by a Nazi kamikaze. In an effort to raise his spirits, Weasel, editor of the Yediot Aharonot, Dov Yadusky, and wife Leah came to America for a visit. And as Weasel would later describe in All Rivers Run to the Sea, 1995, we went to concerts, restaurants. By now I was walking with a cane after that son of a bitch Nazi ran over me, which I thought made me look distinguished, but I tired easily. They rented a car and invited me to join them on a 6-week cross-country trip from New York City to Los Angeles to see some Jews out there. Since Dove was my boss, I didn't have to worry about work, so I went. We discovered an America unknown to us, totally unkosher, totally different from New York or Washington, which were the only places I knew. Interminable highways disappearing into a blue horizon, ringed by tall mountains embedded in the skies in shifting colors. There were cascades of river. Well, I'm not going to go on too far with this because what happened was, Weasel goes on to describe three stops from his 6-week trip. The Grand Canyon, that's where he dropped a penny in the bottom and the Jews dug it out. Las Vegas, and that's where they took the money from the canyon and invested it. And at an American Mongol reservation in Arizona, where he met a Holocaust survivor who made his living as an Indian by day, remaining a Jew by night. Well, that figures. That isn't that. And made a note in his diary, America is truly wonderful, a wonderland. Even the Mongols speak Yiddish. Any way to make a buck, huh, Jaime? After reading his account, I was intrigued with where else Eli Weasel might have gone on that 6-week-long American road trip. Upon further research, I was surprised that there wasn't any further mention of this trip within the vast literature and scholarly discussion that emerged over the past half century surrounding Eli the Weasel. While there have been several bibliographies and collections of Weasel's articles published over the years, one scholar was honest enough to state that no attempt was made to list the articles written by Mr. Weasel, who was a correspondent. Nearly all the scholars who have studied the work of the Weasel over the past century have ignored his Yiddish newspaper articles. Wow. Well, anyhow, let's go on down here. Well, the long and short of the story was, as the article continues, it reads, as one would expect, like a tourist would describe visiting a new location, Disneyland is located in California, 30 miles from Los Angeles, and despite the fact its name does not appear on any official map of California, and certainly not on a map of America, you can go to any travel agency, be it in New York, Paris, Tel Aviv, or Tokyo, in Berlin or Johannesburg, and buy a plane ticket to Disneyland. So anyhow, the Weasel went to Disneyland, and that excited him. Let me see here if there's anything interesting about the Weasel down there. I don't know. From the entrance fee to Disneyland, $1. That must have really been back in the day. In contrast, Disney announced several months ago that a single-day ticket was now $99. Weasel takes his reader on a tour around a park where before your astonished eyes unfolds a magical realm. First there was Auschwitz, a replicated version of Auschwitz. Then there was Buchenwald, and he was thrilled when he saw these things. What a wonderful tribute to the con job that we pulled on the Aryans. Yeah. Well, that's it. I'm tired of the Weasel. Oh, yeah, Buchenwald was right next to Tom Sawyer's Island, if you've ever been down to Disneyland. Yeah. Oh, you missed it? Well, that's too bad. Stumbled onto a little article here that why Zionism is Americanism, if you want to believe that. Zionism is Americanism. Louis D. Brandeis' Jeffersonian ideals about democratic participation and small-scale self-government eventually came to focus on the distant place where he dared to believe that it could be achieved. That place was Palestine. Raised as an unobservant and non-practicing Jew, Brandeis experienced a remarkable personal and intellectual transformation in his 50s. He became the head of the Zionist movement in America. How did he become a Zionist? Although he never denied his Judaism, Brandeis had identified only marginally with Jews since his childhood in Louisville, in keeping with the secular tradition of his ancestors. This changed in 1910. Throughout long years, which represent my own life, I have been to a great extent separated from the Jews. Well, I can imagine a Jew wanting to be separated from the Jews. Brandeis declared in 1914 during his remarks at an emergency meeting of the American Zionists at the Hotel Marseille in New York, which he agreed to chair at the request of a young Zionist and cultural critic, Horace Cullen. Quote, I am very ignorant in things Jewish. But he went on to say that recent experiences, public and professional, have taught me this. I find Jews possessed of those very qualities which we of the 20th century seek to develop in our struggle for justice, democracy, and to rule over everybody in the world. A deep moral feeling which makes them capable of noble acts. A deep sense of brotherhood of man and the high intelligence. The fruits of 3,000 years of civilization, warring, killing, raping. All of these experiences convinced Brandeis that the Jewish people should be preserved. What were the public and professional experiences that transformed Brandeis' outlook from indifference about Judaism to crusading Zionism? By his own account, he had come to Zionism through Americanism. Before 1910, Brandeis, like many upper-class American Jews of Central European heritage, was skeptical of Zionism because of his concerns about dual loyalties and his support for melting pot assimilation. His first public comments about Judaism can be found in 1905 in a speech commemorating the 250th anniversary of the Jewish settlement in America at the New Century Club in New York. What a sad day that would have been. In the speech, quote, "What loyalty demands," Brandeis echoed Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson in warning of the dangers of separation. Got that? Warning of the dangers of separation. In a country whose constitution prohibits discrimination on account of race or creed, there's no place for what President Roosevelt has called hyphenated Americans, Brandeis declared. Habits of living or of thought which tend to keep alive difference of origin or to classify men according to their religious beliefs are inconsistent with the American ideal of brotherhood and are disloyal. In other words, a form of communism is more fun. In fall of 1910, Brandeis first met Jacob D. Haas, editor of the Jewish Advocate in Boston, who had been summoned with other local reporters by the public relations agent of the Savings Bank Insurance Campaign. De Haas was the American secretary of Theodore Herzl, whose 1896 book, Der Judenstaat, had proclaimed the Jewish people's need for a state of their own, and they chose the United States. He had came to America as Herzl's representative to convene the first Zionist Congress in Chicago. In the following year, after immigrating to America in 1902, he eventually moved to Boston to spread his distasteful activity. De Haas was initially ambivalent about the press roundup for savings bank insurance. The theme seemed both dry and remote, as he put it later in his biography of Brandeis. But the interview was a success, and after his interview with De Haas, Brandeis made his first recorded statement on Zionism. Quote, "I have a great deal of sympathy for the movement and am deeply interested in the outcome of the propaganda," unquote, Brandeis declared to the Advocate newspaper. "I believe that Jews can be just as much of a priest people today as they ever were in prophetic days." Brandeis was especially receptive to Zionism in 1910, having been moved by his experience working in Eastern Europe with Eastern European Jews on both sides of the cloakmakers' strike in New York earlier that year. During the negotiations, both the Jewish garment workers and their Jewish employers impressed him with their intellectualism, idealism, and commitment to industrial democracy, as well as their account of anti-Semitism that led them to immigrate from Eastern Europe so they could muddy the waters in the United States like they had done in Eastern Europe. That's enough of that article, but it's all about Zionism and how their whole idea is to mix everybody up. If we just mix everybody up, everything will be wonderful. Don't forget, he was a Supreme Court justice, so you had a Zionist at the top of the Supreme Court there looking down on white working people and deciding their future. Well, a Jewish studies lecture has been canceled in the EU capital in Brussels due to safety concerns. Isn't that interesting? The Jews are so afraid in Europe now, they can't even have a big meeting in the capital of the EU. Well, I see the House GOP report faults the military on the Benghazi attacks. Not Madam Clinton, but the military itself. I thought the Republicans were pro-military. Well, I read you that story about two white guys that are dastardly racists who threw some eggs at black people standing around the bus stop. Now, that story is going worldwide with both of their pictures, big pictures. It's going everywhere. That's a worldwide story. Two white guys throw eggs at black. Well, here's another story that I think is more important and more serious. Baby goats were the victims of an apparent prank last Thursday at the Chicago High School for Agricultural Sciences in the city's Mount Greenwood neighborhood. The school's principal said the vandals forced their way into the animal science wing. The baby goats were found covered with eggs, and a mother goat was found with a rope around her neck. Nothing was stolen. There was no damage, but the students who helped raise the animals made the disturbing discovery. Quote, "They're as confused as anyone else of why you would want to throw eggs at baby goats," Assistant Principal Sheila Fowler said. Well, this is an obvious hate crime. They hate goats. They were white goats. And these were black kids throwing eggs at white goats. So there you've got a hate crime. Deal with it. Deal with it. Splash that all over the world.
An artist, a design, and we want a monument built to the victims of Orlando and the victims of hate crimes everywhere. We want the monument to be either in Christopher Park or Hudson River Park or Battery Park City in the gaze of the Statue of Liberty.
Well, that was Governor Andrew Cuomo appearing with the LGBTQXYZ rights advocates, announcing the state will erect, interesting choice of words, a memorial in tribute to the victims of the Orlando nightclub attack and all the other hate crimes going on everywhere, including throwing eggs at black people. The Democratic governor said that the state will appoint a commission to oversee the project, of which each commissioner will be paid $50,000 a year while they study the thing to do. I mean, you know, that commission is going to pick an artist, a design. We want the monument built, and we're going to get it built, and it's going to cost a lot of money, but taxpayers, it's all right. You got money. Don't you just love the way the ruling class operate? No problem. Here's the money. We're going to build a great big-ass monument here, and it's going to cost lots of money, but it's going to bring some of those people back to life, I think, from Orlando. And also, we're going to erect it. This is an interview with Cornel West, who was a black man. And his comments on the bitch of the Amazon queen. Let's hear what Cornel West says about her.
With you guys, tonight out of Cornel West on CNN. He was speaking with Chris Cuomo, and in this interview, he slayed Hillary Clinton. He was relentless and ruthless, and it was hilarious, honestly, in the way that he did it. So take a look at what he had to say.
The presumption from the Clinton campaign is this isn't just about likability. This isn't just about familiarity. This is about what has been done. And while Bernie Sanders says the right things, he's had a lot of years in the Senate, he has not done things for the African community the way Hillary Clinton has. Fair criticism?
No, not at all. I mean, Bernie Sanders, one of the two white public officials who supported Jesse Jackson in the 80s. It took tremendous courage. Why did Brother Jesse win the primary in Vermont? Bernie Sanders. My dear Brother Chris, Sister Hillary Clinton is the Milli Vanilli of American politics. She lip syncs, she gives lip service, but when it comes to policy, who supported crime bill? Who supported the not just deregulating the market of banks, but also pulled the rug from under welfare? She talks about her work with the Children's Defense Fund way back in the 70s, doesn't say a word about being a Goldwater girl, doesn't say a word about supporting a candidate who Martin Luther King called there's no moral case for Goldwater, he's the most dangerous politician. She's vigorously campaigning. She shows up and gives these wonderful speeches sounding like Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders on the ground getting arrested, marching with Martin. The problem is black voters don't know his history in the way in which they know the symbolic language of Hillary Clinton. But on the ground, she's calling black youth super predators in the 1990s. That is the most demeaning, degrading language to our precious young folk. Sometimes do the wrong thing, yes. Acting gangsters, yes. We know they got gangsters on Wall Street. How many Wall Street executives go to jail?
She's
zero. She's too tied to Wall Street with all that big Wall Street money flowing her way, my brother.
She says on the other side, I voted for the Brady Bill. Bernie Sanders voted against it many times. He wanted to protect gun manufacturers. He hasn't done what I've done to address the actual problems.
Then why does he have a D-minus when it comes to the NRA? She uses that one little element to take the subject matter somewhere else and not focus
Brady
on her
record. Is a little element to the African-American community?
One element in terms of jobs with a living wage, when it comes to education, when it comes to decent housing, and when it comes to Wall Street. You know, and I know she and Bill received $151 million.
You're saying the money's the problem?
Unless she thinks we were born at night but not last night. Good God Almighty. We know the Wall Street influence on her has been intense. That's precisely why she and Bill repealed Glass-Steagall. These have direct connection with black folk. We got a neoliberal black political class who's on the Clinton bandwagon and the gravy train. And they are trying to convince large numbers of black folks we won't do it. Now, part of the problem is, my brother, corporate media hasn't been as fair to Bernie as it should. You all did encourage him, and I appreciate that. But when it comes to
nobody's had him on more than New Day has.
No, this particular program has been, I'm talking about corporate media as a whole, because, I mean, we know Donald Trump himself is a Frankenstein of corporate media. They cover every Twitter, they cover every speech, every word of it. If Bernie had that kind of coverage, people wouldn't know who he is.
He's got his own hashtag.
But look how much money he saved because the corporate media follows him every second, every minute. But when it comes to Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, Bernie had got to this show, but now your show is not typical. He hasn't got the exposure to see one fundamental thing: profound integrity, genuine conviction, and on the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. What other higher standard do we have in American politics? How many politicians do we know have genuine integrity?
That
you can count them on your hand. Hillary Clinton's not one of them. She's not one of them, bro.
I want to go through some of the things that he said.
Well, a former leader of the KKK up in Canada has gotten himself in a little problem. Man fatally stabbed on Furby Street, former leader of the Manitoba KKK. The 45-year-old victim of a fatal stabbing in Winnipeg's inner city was... Oh, it was the Ku Klux Klan leader that got killed. He was stabbed to death. Police were called to the 400 block of Furby Street for a serious assault about 3 a.m. Thursday. James Edsel Tucker was rushed to the hospital in critical condition but later died. Police have confirmed Tucker was previously known as William James Harkus in the 90s. Harkus was known as the leader of the Manitoba KKK. In 1992, the Manitoba Coalition Against Racism and Apartheid and two other complainants filed a human rights complaint against Harkus and the Manitoba KKK. They were tried in court, and following a three-year Canadian Human Rights Tribunal hearing, the judge ordered Harkus and the KKK to stop a phone line they created where callers received messages and targeted non-white races and Jews. That's freedom of speech in Canada. Couldn't even have a phone line. I know, I'm trying to remember the man I knew up there that had been thrown in jail several times for having a phone machine. Police said Tucker's death was not connected to his role in the KKK. Well, how do they know? This incident has nothing to do with his past, Constable Jason Muckleshin said Sunday, adding, investigators do not believe Tucker had been actively involved in the white supremacist movement. Joshua Evans, 24, and Martin Archie Flett, 22, were charged with second-degree murder in connection with the stabbing. And I'll bet you they were black. Maybe not, but I'll bet you. Let's go back in history of this man. The complaints to the Human Rights Tribunal in 1992 alleged the KKK hotline, which operated in Winnipeg between May 1991 and December 1991, until police brought criminal charges, delivered messages likely to arouse hatred against people based on their race, color, national and ethnic origin, or religion. Oh, that's too bad. Some of the messages directly targeted members of the local anti-racist movement, the complainants alleged. In other words, they exposed these rats in the far left. After the criminal case against the three KKK members fell apart in 1992, a magistrate banned all three men from owning weapons, ammunition, or explosives for 5 years. That's interesting. Police had already seized weapons from two of the men, which had never been charged with using a weapon illegally. And the court heard one of the men had met with Harkus and undercover police officers in December 1991 and discussed how to obtain weapons illegally. There you go. Informants, informants, informants. Chief Magistrate Don Dalbinko said he considered the ban necessary because he believed the men could possibly, maybe, pose a threat to the public, particularly members of non-white groups. Well, it's too bad you got knifed and killed. So we're sorry to hear that. Sorry to hear that. We hope the guys who did it sooner or later pay the price and are dealt with. Well, I thought they were going to show some video and audio on that particular case. They showed some video of the cops in the building where the man lived, but that was it. You know that riot that took place up in, or that attack that took place on these traditionalist Workers' Party people in Sacramento? I've yet to see any description of who stabbed who. Who was being stabbed and who was doing the stabbing. If anybody's got any information on that, let me know. Since they don't seem to be releasing that information, it's probably obvious to me that they're covering up for the extreme left, as they want to call them, the non-whites, who are doing the stabbing. Well, that's it for now, boys and girls. I'll be back tomorrow on Wotan's Day, Dave Lane's favorite day.
Try something good, I'm takes over the town. The sun keeps shining in the north, we keep it up speed. Don't forget about myself for a while, though I have to see what others need. I've been sitting down steady in the art of love. I think it'll fit me like a glove. I want some real good woman to do just what I say. Everybody got to wonder what's the matter with this cruel world today.
Take pity on me.